and ultimately led to the shutdown of both of those nuclear reactors. At St. Lucie, something interesting happened. St. Lucie Unit 1 was replaced with one design, and St. Lucie Unit 2 was replaced by a company called Areva, a French manufacturer, with another design. We had no problems with the steam generators at St. Lucie 1. There was a huge difference between the steam generator damage at St. Lucie 1, and which is almost nothing, and the steam generator damage at St. Lucie 2. The St. Lucie 2 steam generators are identical to the problems encountered at San Onofre, and they made the same mistakes at St. Lucie that they did at San Onofre. Two specifically, they removed something called a stay cylinder, which is sort of like a pillar in front of the Washington, in front of the Lincoln Memorial or something like that. It's an upright pillar. And in the place of that pillar, they added extra tubes. St. Lucie 1 did not do this. And therein lies the key difference between the fact that one unit is running fine and the other one is severely damaged. The what this does is it puts too much heat into the center of the steam generator, and heat means more bubbles, and bubbles create vibration. So the steam bubbles are causing the pipes to shake and vibrate against the supporting plates that hold them apart. I have to refer everybody to an excellent article in the paper yesterday, Tampa Bay Times, Ivan Penn. There's a great table in there that I really don't have to go into, but the St. Lucie has almost double the number of tubes that are damaged that San Onofre had, with slightly more wear indications, which means that on average every damaged tube at San Onofre had about four and a half indications, and every damaged tube at St. Lucie had about three, because there are more damaged tubes at St. Lucie. But the more important number is the growth in the number of cracks, and in the number of dents, rather, that exceed 20%. When they started the plan up in 2008, after replacing the steam generators, 1 year later, they looked at the tubes and found 75 that had indications that were more than a 20% dent. The next outage, now they're on an 18-month outage, they had over 1,000. And in 2012, they had almost 2,000. Now, what happened in between there was in January of 2012, San Onofre blew a tube and discovered extensive tube damage. Against this background, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allowed a 12% power increase in the St. Lucie Unit 2 unit. And that's going to create more bubbles, which is going to create more damage. The safety ramifications are significant. Dr. Joe Hoppenfeld and I wrote a paper on San Onofre that applies to this one as well. Whereas if one tube breaks, operators are trained on how to handle that. But the net effect is that the radioactive water that cools the nuclear reactor leaves the nuclear reactor through the broken tube and needs to be replenished. The problem with so many dented tubes is that it's not clear to either Dr. Hoppenfeld or I that the damage would be limited to one tube and you could get cascading failures. Nuclear reactors are not, and operators are not trained on how to handle cascading steam generator failures. So there is a very real risk, especially given at St. Lucie 2, the huge number of damaged tubes, of cascading tube failures, and the plant is not designed to accommodate that. So it does present a reliability risk in that if one tube breaks, the plant will shut down, and it presents a significant safety risk, whereas if two tubes break, there's not enough water to cool the nuclear reactor. So I agree with Steve and with SACE, who has retained me to help out here, that there there are questions that need to be addressed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Why did they make a difference between St. Lucie 1, which is running fine, and St. Lucie 2? Why did they allow St. Lucie 2 to increase its power by 12%? At the same time, we know that San Onofre, who made the identical changes, was falling apart. There's significant questions that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Florida Power and Light need to answer before this plant starts back up again after the upcoming outage. Thank you.
Thank you, Arnie and Steve. We appreciate your comments there. I'm going to go ahead and open this up for question and answer session for the reporters who have joined us today. And I'd like to remind our attendees that this is a telepress conference, so questions from the media are going to be given higher priority. If you are with the media and you have a question, please press star 6 to unmute your lines. And if you can, once again, please just state your name and your outlet as you ask your question.
Hi, it's can you all hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry, it's Matt Bandick from SNL Energy. First, was wondering if the NRC, and I'm assuming they're NRC documents in question that show that the extent of the damage, and then apparently, as Stephen mentioned, that the FPL knew that the uprates would worsen the damage. Are those documents available? And because I haven't seen them, and I'd be interested in receiving those if that's possible. But then kind of on a related note, my question was that from what, and again, I haven't seen the documents, but from the Tampa Bay Times story, it looks like the specific numbers about the tube wear are from documents that are at least a couple years old. Just wondering, do we know where it stands right now? How recent is the information here about the damage at the plant?
Well, this is Arnie. Let me say, go ahead, Arnie, if you want to answer that.
Every outage, the plant is required to complete an outage report. So there was an outage, and now these plants are on 18-month cycles. So there was an outage in 2009, followed by an outage in 2011. And then there will be an outage in 2012, and then there was one in 2014. So they're 18 months apart. Those outage reports are generated about 90 days after the outage and provide all of this information. So the reason the information is dated is because the last time they opened the steam generator was in 2012, and that's when they found that they had almost 2,000 tubes with indications over 20%. So the next time they open it will be roughly March 5th, 6th, 7th, at which point we're asking for 100% re-examination of all the tubes. So the reason the information appears dated is that it's based on the last outage. You can't look at these tubes unless you shut down, and that has not happened.
And yes, we can provide the information that we have about the numbers from the last time and the fact that there was correspondence between FPL and the NRC about there would be approximately, I think it's a 24% possibility of a 24% increase in the wear and damage to the steam generator with the uprate. Because remember, the reactor was designed at one level, and now they've actually taken it to where they're running it harder, which puts more stress on the component.
Right.
Other questions?
Yeah, this is Mark Chediak with Bloomberg News. Can you hear me?
Yes,
we can.
Yeah, first question is, were the modifications to Unit 2, were they made during the uprate or before that?
The modifications to Unit 2 were made as part of the power uprate. Actually, they were made before the power upgrade. In 2008, the steam generators were replaced, and it was 3 years later when the power was increased.
So the modifications were made with the replacement of the steam generators, is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay. And the second question I had is there was a question raised about whether or not the design of the steam generators has been altered to the point where the NRC may need to look at that. Is there are there plans to sort of challenge the NRC to look at a license amendment request or something like that?
That's I think that's a $64,000 question here. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission did not approve the changes to the San Onofre units, nor did it approve the changes to either St. Lucie 1 or St. Lucie 2. The utility convinced itself that the new steam generators were what they call like-for-like replacements mm-hmm. with the old steam generators. Mm-hmm. And if the utility convinces itself that they are like-for-like, the NRC does not evaluate the modifications. It was our position with Friends of the Earth that the changes were not just minor improvements, but actually major experiments. And I think the same thing happened with St. Lucie 2. The St. Lucie 1, it's clear, was a like-for-like replacement. They kept the stay cylinder. They didn't add the extra tubes. But St. Lucie 2 squeezed the orange a little bit too much, and they replaced the stay cylinder with an air gap, and in that gap they put in extra tubes. And the net effect is that an enormous amount of power is now generated in a part of the steam generator that had no power before. And power is steam bubbles, and steam bubbles cause pipes to vibrate. So the problem is that this rule, this NRC like-for-like rule, is called 10 CFR 50.59, and it has been abused by utilities to really stretch the envelope. The changes inside St. Lucie 1 clearly were like-for-like, but the changes inside the steam generator St. Lucie 2 are nowhere near like-for-like. And I think that's one of the key questions that came up on San Onofre and should have been asked at St. Lucie by the NRC during the power upgrade, but the NRC doesn't want to ask that question.
Right, and this is the basis for, and this is Stephen Smith speaking, the basis for one of the things that is point number three in our call is that FPNL used the uprate and the use this as a way to increase the power and use ratepayer money, but they knew that there was indication that more damage was already happening in the reactor. And so the prudent thing for them to have done would have been to go slow here and not accelerate the potential damage. And this is why this outage is so important, because we believe that where the steam generators should, if the ratepayers pay for them, they should last, 30-plus years. We're now less than 10 years into this steam generator, the steam generators in St. Lucie 2, and they're already severely damaged. And this is, we believe, an imprudent action by the utility that has been done at the expense of the ratepayers. And unfortunately, we have a overly compliant, we call it sort of a wholly owned subsidiary, Public Service Commission that tends to rubber stamp everything the utility wants. And this is an example where, again, we have these unintended consequences where the legislature was led to believe that this early cost recovery law would help save consumers money. The utilities took advantage of it, and we've seen devastating impact in what happened with Crystal River 3, and now we have another reactor in Florida where this law has been abused, and potentially there's millions of dollars at stake.
The other thing I'd like to add is that... Oh, go ahead, Steve.
No, that's it.
Okay, the other thing I'd like to add is when I was representing Friends of the Earth on San Onofre, I met with Dr. Greg Yasko, who was the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at the time. And Yasko said that his take-home message on the San Onofre problem was that the 5059 process, this process of like for like, has been, you know, grossly abused by utilities, and not just San Onofre, but other utilities. And obviously, St. Lucie 2 falls into that same category of gross abuse of a regulation.
All right, thank you very much.
Hi, this is Susan Salisbury. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm with the Palm Beach Post. And I was told by the NRC that the steam generator at San Onofre and St. Lucie are two different types and that it wasn't fair to compare them. Can you address that? Is that true? Or they just said it wasn't, it's comparing apples to grapefruit and it's not the same. And then the other thing they said was it's not the number of marks or indentations that matters. It's how deep they are. And anyway, what about that?
Well, the steam generators at San Onofre and the steam generators at both St. Lucie 1 and 2 are essentially identical. San Onofre was a little bit bigger, but essentially identical. Same vendor, two steam generators per reactor, et cetera. Actually, the people at San Onofre compared San Onofre to St. Lucie. So it's not a case of Southern Alliance or Arnie Gunderson comparing the two. The comparison was made by another utility, Southern California Edison. And they said that they were just like San Onofre Unit, St. Lucie. Southern California Edison said they were just like St. Lucie Unit 2. And St. Lucie 2 had all these tube leaks, all these damaged tubes. And so why couldn't they then run with the same number of damaged tubes? That was the argument that that the utility in California made. The denting at both units is significant. The denting at San Onofre was a little bit deeper on some of the tubes. They wound up plugging almost 800 tubes, whereas this unit has plugged a little over 100 tubes. But most reactors don't plug any tubes, so that in comparison, these three, San Onofre 2, 3, and St. Lucie 2, are outliers compared to the rest of the pack. And again, I refer you to the fact that St. Lucie 1 has no problems.
Yeah, and so this is Steve with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. This is why what we're calling for, we don't have an absolute crystal ball here. We don't know exactly what we're going to find or what the utility will find during this outage. But there's enough evidence going in that there were significant number of damaged tubes. The depth of the damage was increasing. That was outlined in Ivan's article. And that there's also concern that because they uprated the power output, that we would likely see more. So this is why it is so critical that FP&L take a go-slow approach here. They don't need to rush. They're not in critical energy mode. This isn't the heat of the summer. This is what's called the shoulder season. They can take the time to really go slow here and make sure that they do the 100% inspection and that those results are made public before they restart the reactor to assure everyone. Because leading up to this outage, there's some really clear and compelling evidence that we need to take a really hard look at it. And we don't need to see them rush to put the reactor back on until there's an opportunity for some independent evaluation of what they find. It may be they find that the wear rates are not increasing, they're not significant, and that the reactor can be safely operated, and that's all the better. We would welcome that outcome because it'll end up saving customers money, but there's no reason to rush and not have a full and transparent disclosure of what the conditions of the steam generators are, and that's all we're asking for from FPNL, and we think they should embrace this. FPNL should welcome this, and they should want to make everything open and transparent and shouldn't try to just rush to put the reactor back online.
Okay. Now, are any of you nuclear engineers? Arnie's a nuclear engineer?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's and master's in nuclear. I was actually one of the co-inventors of something called the steam generator nozzle dam, which is used to to allow inspectors into a steam generator so they can do these types of inspections.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Matt Bannock from SNL. One quick question. Just Arnie mentioned that apparently Southern California Edison once compared their steam generator to St. Lucie. Just wondering where can I find that, where they said that?
I've already provided Southern Alliance with those links.
Okay.
Can Southern Alliance put that out, or do you want me to resend?
Yeah, I think we've got those. We can put those up on our website. We've just recently published a blog about this, and maybe the thing to do would be to add those links into the blog. Maybe we can also add them onto an updated version of the press release.
We can do all of the above, and so those will be updated within the hour, both on the press release, which is on our homepage at cleanenergy.org, as well as the top of the blog. Do we have any other questions from anyone else on the call?
This is Susan Salisbury. I had one more question.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, can you tell me what the worst-case scenario really is? Because I was told today the worst-case scenario that Tampa Bay Times presented, a tube burst and spews radioactive fluid, that wouldn't happen because the plant would be shut down before that happened. Can you give me an idea what would be the worst-case scenario?
Well, the worst-case scenario... the NRC calls something the design bases accident. And the NRC assumes that the worst that can happen is a single tube bursts. And if a single tube bursts, the radioactive fluid, which is at 2,000 pounds, shoots through the hole to the steam side, which is at 1,000 pounds. So there's a 1,000-pound pressure differential. And the hot radioactive steam gets into the secondary side of the plant and is released out of something called the steam jet air ejector, into the air. The plant releases radiation into the air. At that point, radiation monitors would shut the nuclear reactor down. And at that point, there's a release of radiation, and there's also a lowering of the amount of water in the nuclear reactor. But there's enough water in the other systems to make up for that water, and you don't have a meltdown. That's what the NRC says is the worst case, and that's what operators are trained to handle. But given the huge number of damaged tubes, it's not clear to Dr. Joe Hoppenfeld and I that a single tube failure is the limiting issue. If two tubes break, if one tube breaks and hits another one and it breaks, then they cascade. So if you have two tubes break, operators are not trained at how to handle that, and there is not enough fluid in the nuclear reactor, and you begin to drain the nuclear reactor core and can cause core damage. So if you stay within the box that the NRC draws, it's a release of radiation with a reliability problem. The plant is shut down for months. However, given the extensive amount of damage to tubes and the possibility that they can cascade, you wind up with a severe accident.
So do you consider the NRC negligent at this point, that they've allowed it to operate like it is now? Or you're just saying it needs to be investigated during this next outage?
Well, we have concerns. We believe that the NRC needs to come forward with a better explanation, given the lessons learned at San Onofre. We absolutely believe that this outage requires a significant amount of due diligence that should be done in an open and transparent manner and should allow full public disclosure and independent evaluation. One of the things, Susan, that's really critical that I would reference to you is that when the Fukushima accident happened a few years back, it was the cascading set of events that took place there was never supposed to happen.
Right.
And one of the that the NRC took was supposed to take to heart was that they needed to look beyond this design basis and be open for really studying whether events can cascade out of hand. And what we are disappointed in is that the NRC does not seem to be really taking that to heart. And here is an example of what we think is a clear and present danger that the NRC should be using the precautionary principle and be very careful about. Again, it may be that when the reactor is opened up and the evaluation is done, that we're going to learn some lessons, and maybe there hasn't been as much wear as some would anticipate. But I think that going into this outage, there is certainly a lot of evidence, and that's why we're not calling for the immediate shutdown of the reactor, you know, today, and we're not screaming about FPNL operating its nuclear reactors. They're going to try to characterize it that way. They're going to try to characterize us as, you know, being anti-nuclear and against everything, this, that, and the other. The reality, though, is that, you know, nuclear power plants are inherently unforgiving, and they have to be operated precisely, and you want to try to get ahead of any events that could potentially lead to something, as Arnie described, a cascading set of events.
Right.
That's what we're asking for. Let's be cautious here. Let's go slow. Let's make it open and transparent, and let's make sure we incorporate all the lessons learned from other reactors that we've since the St. Lucie modifications have taken place.
Okay, thank you.
Susan, this is George Capros. Just to add to Arnie and Steve's statement, in addition to the technical and the public health worst-case scenarios, there's also the impact, a potential impact on customers in a worst-case scenario where the company would have to shut down the plant. The company has recovered approximately $1.2 billion in total for both the St. Lucie 1 and St. Lucie 2 upgrade projects. We have not at this time been able to apportion how much went to 1 and how much went to 2. But should that plant have to be shut down, that investment would be lost. And since the company has already recovered those costs under the Nuclear Cost Recovery Act.
You mean should it have to be shut down permanently, is what you're saying?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had asked about worst-case scenarios, correct?
Okay.
So the investment in that plant would be lost. In addition, there would have to be replacement fuel costs, because you would lose a reactor that is now has a capacity of about 900 megawatt capacity, and you lose that from your system, you're going to have to go out and purchase power or run your natural gas plants much more aggressively, which will increase fuel costs considerably for customers. And I'll give you an example. When the Crystal River Unit 3 reactor went offline for what was then Progress Energy Florida, they were racking up replacement fuel costs at a rate of $400 million a year.
And the other thing, Susan, that maybe even more likely, I mean, we don't know yet what we're going to find, is that the steam generator, which should last for decades, may be being prematurely worn out by the upgrade and this could have significant costs to consumers if they have to go in and do a steam generator replacement before they got the full value of the steam generator. So there's a couple of different scenarios that may play out here. And so I think this is why we need to really understand what is happening and how the company is running the reactor, which, again, clearly had signs of damage. It was of concern to a number of folks. And we've got more information now, and so we need to really understand this. So we don't have the crystal ball exactly where this is going, and we're not predicting exactly what the outcome is going to be, but we do want an open, transparent, and fully documented inspection that allows independent evaluation before they rush to put the thing back online.
And this should take longer than normal? Whatever the normal outage time is, but you're asking for, that would take longer?
Well, not necessarily. Okay. I guess, like I say, they're already committed to doing the 100% inspection. I think what we're asking for that may be a little unusual is that the results of that are made public for independent evaluation before the reactor. See, normally the utility may take 3 or 4 months before they actually report what they found. They put the reactor back on service, and they're operating it back in the old way that they were, which may or may not be causing damage. And by the time anybody in the public gets any understanding of what was found there, the reactor's back operational and, you know, potentially causing even more damage. So what we're asking for that I think is unusual is a slowing down, or at least you can either say it's a slowing down of restarting the reactor or an acceleration of making the information public for independent evaluation. So I guess it's up to FP&L and the NRC how they want to respond to our request.
Right. Have you ever made a request like that before and they've said yes, or they just nothing?
Well, let me tell you, I mean, and Arnie has indicated this too. We are on uncharted territory here. You have a company that made design modification changes to their reactor, knowing that, I mean, that now are showing increased damage, and then they went and petitioned to upgrade the reactor, even though they know that the damage was there, and they're running it harder and likely creating more damage. So, no, this is not something that happens every day in the nuclear reactor world. This is what's so unusual about what FP&L is doing. That's why we think it's been imprudent.
Right.
Yeah, there were only 3 reactors that did. They were combustion design, they removed the stay cylinder, and they added extra tubes. And that's San Onofre 2 and 3 and St. Lucie 2. Two of those 3 reactors that made those changes were damaged to the point that they were not economical and were shut down permanently. So what we're asking for is what makes St. Lucie 2 any different than St. Lucie... I'm sorry, what makes St. Lucie 2 any different than San Onofre 2 and 3.
And
what are the differences between St. Lucie 1, which is running just fine, and St. Lucie 2, which has severe damage?
All right, thank you.
Are there any further questions from anyone on this call? If not, Stephen Smith, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, would like to give a closing statement.
Well, again, just very briefly, you know, safety is job one here. We need to ask that the utility, who I get has significant financial motivation to rush as quickly as possible through the refueling, to slow down, to basically make sure that we have a transparent, open, and the ability for an independent evaluation of what the inspection finds at this particular reactor. 2, we think the NRC needs to come forward and explain, you know, what it's doing with this like for like, what lessons have been learned from San Onofre and how they apply to St. Lucie 2, and we need them to do their job, which is provide their regulatory oversight with safety primarily in mind. And three, we think it is timely and important, based on these results, for the state legislature to reevaluate this nuclear cost recovery law that has allowed, we think, FPL to take reckless action and potentially cause premature wear and damage to their steam generator, which will have significant implications to ratepayers. So we want, first and foremost, let's be safe, let's be cautious, let's be transparent and open, and let's see what's going on. Let's make sure that we're regulating the way we're supposed to, and let's make sure that the companies are not using an overly compliant public service commission to basically waste ratepayer money by taking imprudent and reckless action. That's what we're asking for the investigations to be done and for this to play out. And we ask for you guys to continue to track the story. We think it's important. We think the implications are very, very large. And we appreciate you taking the time to join us for a little bit today. And we look forward to continuing the dialogue with you and answer any questions you have in the future.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you all for attending. And as Steve and Arnie indicated earlier, we will get links to some of those files that were mentioned earlier up on both the press statement, which can be found at cleanenergy.org, as well as on the blog, which is Footprints at Clean Energy. So both of those will be updated a little bit later this afternoon.